The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So happy Mother's Day to begin with, all you hardworking moms. So today's talk is about conceit. The conceit of I am, the conceit of self. Can you hear me? It's okay? All right, great. So conceit in a Buddhist context has a specific meaning. So when we think of conceit, generally we have a sense of sort of pridefulness or kind of puffed up ego, which is also true of the Buddhist concept of conceit. But it also means a sense of unworthiness. When we have a feeling of not being as good as, this is also a form of conceit. It's actually a form of arrogance. Isn't that interesting? Arrogance has a particular flavor, doesn't it? It assumes we know we are not worthy or we are better than. And so the Buddha instructed very usefully to pay attention to conceit, that this is a source of great suffering in our lives, and it is in fact based on a delusion. It's a lie, in Michelle MacDonald Smith's pithy statement. I love it. So let's just look at this, sort of this sense of self. These are the words of Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Sumedho is a senior teacher from the Thai Forest tradition. He's been an important influence here at the center. And this is him talking about when he was first needing to give Dhamma talks in Thailand as a monk. And he was just learning to speak Thai, so it brought up a lot of self-consciousness and difficulty. So he's just commenting on this. And his teacher was Ajahn Chah. So here he says, Ajahn Chah would always encourage me to keep aware of the pride, the conceit, the embarrassment, and the self-consciousness that I would feel. And fortunately in Thailand, the people are such that they're just grateful for a monk giving a talk. Even if it's not a very good talk, it doesn't seem to upset them very much. They still seem quite grateful about it. So that made it quite easy. One time at a Katina ceremony where we had to sit up all night, Ajahn Chah said, Sumedho, you have to give a talk for 3 hours tonight. Up until that time, I'd only talked for half an hour, and that was a strain. 3 hours, and he knew. With Ajahn Chah, I always felt that if he said something, I'd do it. So I sat up on the high seat and talked for 3 hours. And I had to sit there and watch people get up and leave. And I had to sit there and watch people just lie down on the floor and sleep in front of me. And at the end of the 3 hours, there were still a few polite old ladies sitting there. So that wasn't Ajahn Chah saying, okay, Sumedho, go in there and bowl them over with some scintillating stuff. Entertain them, really suck it to them. I began to realize that what he wanted me to do was be able to look at this self-consciousness, the posing, the pride, the conceit, the grumbling, the lazy, the not wanting to be bothered, the wanting to please, the wanting to entertain, wanting to get approval. All these have come up during these Dhamma talks over the past 15 years, but the meditation is one in which more and more one feels a real understanding of the suffering of self-view. And then through that insight, one realizes the abiding in emptiness. So these last few lines are a beautiful description to me of this kind of movement from a very narrow, bound self-view, something that's tight, something that needs to be protected, something that needs to be supported, into a place that's much more spacious, much more grounded in the fact of our interdependence. So this sort of beautiful journey. And it's said in the path to liberation that this sense of self can be so subtle that it's one of the very last fetters to disappear. It's such a subtle and powerful force. But at the same time, it's a fetter that we can attend to immediately, like no matter what's going on with our mind, and we can feel relief through through that attention. So I think this attention to conceit, this attention to how we perceive self, is immensely value to be aware of in this whole journey. So here is Sumedho, Ajahn Sumedho, one more time, in a different talk. The sense of oneself is something that we become conscious of when we are children. When we are born, there is no sense of self as being anything. As we grow up, we learn what we are supposed to be, if we are good or bad, if we are lovable or not, if we are approved of or disapproved of. So we develop a sense of ourselves. We also often compare ourselves to others and have role models of what we should be when we grow up. I noticed from my own experience that the ego really started consolidating when I was sent off to school. I was thrown into those classrooms with all those strange children, and then I started noticing who was the strongest, who was the toughest, who was the one the teacher liked the best. We saw ourselves in terms of our relationships to others. This develops through a lifetime unless we deliberately choose to change and start looking more deeply than just living our lives through the conditioning of the mind that we acquired when we were very young. So I feel like this is an invitation to investigate this sensibility of self, not as a doctrine, not as a proclamation, but what is our sense of self, you know? Are we the body? Are we feelings? Are we our will? Are we consciousness? That this is something that we can look deeply into. And the Buddha says, if we look deeply into the nature of the body, if we look deeply into the nature of the mind, that conceit is not possible. So one aspect, one way that conceit shows itself is in what's called the comparing mind, how we compare, how we put ourselves in relationship to others, and even how we put ourselves in relationship to ourselves, to how we maybe used to be, some memory of how we used to be, or an imagined version of ourselves, what we think we should be. Even that's a comparing mind. So looking at comparing mind, and it's threefold. I am better than, I am worse than, I am equal to. Even I am equal to suggests a sense of separation. I am equal to you. So even a sense of equality is built on conceit. So these are the Buddha's words. What is the fetter of conceit? Conceit at the thought, I am the better one. Conceit at the thought, I am as good as they. Conceit at the thought, I am lowly. All such sort of conceit, loftiness, haughtiness, flaunting a flag, assumption, desire of the heart for self-advertisement. This is called conceit. So I think conceit shows itself in really loud ways and in really subtle ways, this comparing mind. So I think, I think we can even consider the way the mind works unconsciously, almost automatically. For instance, even when we enter a room, such as a room like this, filled with people, when we enter the room, 100 assessments happen, hardly in our awareness, hardly a twinkling in our awareness that happens. So we come into a room and there are a group of people that trigger our greed. You know, we see a hairstyle. Oh, I can never get my hair right, you know, or someone is sitting there with such poise and I have such pain in my body and I can't sit like that. Or someone who is just restless and they're moving all over and it's like, why can't you sit still? So a putting down, a sense, I'm better, I can sit still. I can be here quietly. And these things are so quick and so quiet, but they are part of how we continually construct who we are. And it's a source of great suffering. So as the mind quiets, we can begin to see this play, and it is worthy of our investigation. It is worthy of our investigation, and not to assume that this is right. You know, we can look beneath. So how would it be to enter a room with the space of mind that's wide open, that doesn't categorize people into better than or less than? This is the third patriarch of Zen, Sen Tsang. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. These are Buddha's famous words to Bahia. Bahia, in the seeing is just the seen. In the hearing is just the heard. In the sensing is just the sense. So we don't complicate the experience out of self-need. Right? So tied up with comparing mind is always greed or aversion. It's not wise discernment. It's not clear seeing because it's colored by our greed or by our aversion, our pushing away, our not liking. So here again are Buddha's words. One who thinks oneself equal to others or superior or inferior for that very reason is in dispute. But one who is unmoved under those three conditions, for that person, the notions of equal, superior, and inferior do not exist. For one who is free from views, there are no ties. For one who is delivered by understanding, there are no follies. But those who grasp after views and philosophical opinions, they wander about in the world, annoying people. So, this investigation, no solid I behind the process of me, my body, my life. Okay, so I feel like it, I just want to say again, this, we need to discern. So this isn't about not recognizing differences. This isn't about being somehow not discerning. Discerning is essential. We survive through discerning. It's the color of greed or aversion that makes it judgment, that makes it comparing, and that makes it a source of suffering. So wise discernment is rooted in loving kindness, in compassion, and in equanimity. With equanimity, we see clearly. Greed and aversion are a cloud in the mind. We don't see clearly. We cling when there's greed and aversion. So really getting to know, when are we judging and when are we discerning? So how can we tell? Like, to me, that there's a stink, there's a feel to judgment. Even really quietly, we can feel that in the body, we can feel it in the heart. When we're judging someone, there's a taste. Maybe it's subtle or maybe it's loud, but there's a taste if we look for it, you know. So, looking to the state of the heart, and we can recognize our own suffering. Even when we're feeling superior, there's suffering in that comparison. So to look for that, to look for the stickiness, the clinging that comes with feeling better than or putting someone down or feeling less than. So Mara in Buddhism, Mara is almost like the devil. Mara is the force of delusion in Buddhism. In Pali, Mara means killer, killer of virtue. So Mara is a destructive force. And there's 10 armies of Mara, and Mara's 8th, 9th, and 10th armies all have to do with the conceit of self. And I just want to go through what these armies are. So the 8th army of Mara is self-condemnation, and feeling of worthlessness. So I think somehow in our culture we feel like in some funny way feeling badly about ourselves is somehow better than feeling conceited about ourselves. Like I don't know what that is, but we have that. Like I don't know, some Puritan thing, or I don't know what that is, but this is seen as a destructive force to feel badly about ourselves. This is a killer of virtue to feel badly about ourselves. The Dalai Lama just said, it's wrong. That's what he said to a student who was saying, how do I work with self-loathing? How do I work with that? It took a while for the Dalai Lama to understand what do you mean self-loathing? And in a bewilderment, he said, that's wrong. That's the wrong way of seeing, you know. Trungpa Rinpoche said, timidity is just another ego trip. So, I was so happy to hear these teachings. When I first heard these teachings, this was like a way out of all those feelings of worthlessness, of self-condemnation, of, you know, it was a way to, first of all, uproot that assumption, I'm just bad, you know, like whatever that view is, like, oh, that's not necessarily true. Turn your attention here, Wynn. What kind of thoughts are leading to this feeling? What's going on in your body? What's going on in your heart? Over and over and over again, turning my attention. Oh, self-consciousness, what is that like? And just name it again and again and again. I was so grateful to hear that. I was thinking, I found, when I was in high school, I found a Valentine card that I had made when I was probably in second grade, something. I have a vague memory. And I think the teacher had asked, like, what is love? And I'd drawn a big red heart, and a border, like a green, crisp, square border with flowers. And inside the heart, I wrote, if you're pretty and if you're smart, you'll have fun. That was my reading of the world in second grade, right? And can you imagine that view, the kind of suffering that comes from that view? And I think we all have that heart going on. You fill in the blank, you know. Unless I become this, I'm not going to have fun. I'm not going to be filled. I'm not going to be loved, you know. And so this unsaid thing, like I read those words, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I'm embarrassed by that. But it's like that was probably a powerful reading of what I understood going on around me. So, meeting our suffering, our self-condemnation with interest and compassion and kindness. So that's Mars' Eighth Army. Mars' ninth Army, the desire for gain, for reverence, for fame, wanting to feel special. So we all want to feel special, right? Like, how would it be not to have to feel special? We hardly know. We hardly know. And this is what the Buddha compares. One who feeds on fame, he compared that impulse to a dung beetle. And these are his words. It's just like a beetle feeding on dung, full of dung, gorged with dung, standing before a great dung hill, who might despise other beetles, saying, I am a dung eater, full of dung, gorged with dung, and before me is this great dung hill. So the Buddha's sense of humor. Yeah. So we want to feel special. And we can, again, like just recognize this as a place of practice, not condemn it, you know? Just recognize it. Adrienne Ross said something really beautiful. She's an insight teacher. She said, in the yearning of specialness, we are wanting to return to wholeness. So we want to return to wholeness. So there can be some goodness, you know, and she says, we feel there's something missing. It's a homing device. We're just pointing it in the wrong direction. So, taking care of our mind, attending to our mind in this way. So like right now, I have a stack of course evaluations on my desk at McAllister. So at the end of every term, students fill out evaluations. They tell you all the ways in which you're brilliant and all the ways in which you're inadequate, right? In great detail. So this is a trip, right? So it's like, and to recognize that this is a trip. This has the capacity to agitate me. You know, if not a little bit, a lot. You know, so it's like, you know, and I just make a practice of this and of other places in my life that are like that. I either have a bell in my mind, or in this case, I actually sit down with the meditation bell. I ring the bell and I attend to all the energies that move through. She is just the best teacher in McAllister. You know, and I just watch, or, you know, she assigns us readings that she hasn't even read herself. She should not be teaching at McAllister. You know, and to just hold it all with as much compassion as I can muster. You know, just have space, not to cling, you know, not. So we can recognize these places where we're on an edge, you know, where we have the capacity to be thrown, and there's many places, and we can carry around an internal bell. Sweetheart, this is a place that's difficult. Ring your bell. Be present. Be caring. As a way to care for ourselves, as a way to care for ourselves. Mara's 10th army, self-importance, arrogance, putting others down. This made me think of another story from my childhood, a childhood friend who I loved dearly. She's a dear friend. She's a little younger than I was and was socially awkward. You know, she just had troubles, and sometimes she would act out in ways that would rub people the wrong way. One day, she acted out in a way that really rubbed people the wrong way, and me especially, and I felt like she deserved to be set straight. She deserved my punishment. She deserved the punishment of all our little circle of friends. And so we were going to stop talking to her. This was me, the ringleader, because she just deserved this. So, and I remember this feeling of like, we're going to stop talking to her. And sort of walking down my little street in my hometown, Win the Dictator, you know, I was just had a little sense of the power. There was some taste of power. Of my capacity to really hurt her, you know, to really, I wasn't thinking of it in terms of hurting her, but just feeling that energy. And then later, I had a lot of wholesome regret around that. And because it did hurt her, and I saw. It makes me want to cry right now. I saw, you know. So if we don't see this sort of intoxication with arrogance, with power, with better than, then I think we feed it. Unconsciously, we feed it. And I think that's when we begin to hate. And this 10th army is described as the most dangerous of Mara's armies. And this is what deeply separates us. And this is a poem from Galway Canal I'd like to read. In the 20th century of my trespass on earth, having exterminated 1 billion heathens, heretics, Jews, Muslims, witches, mystical seekers, black men, Asians, and Christian brothers, every one of them for his own good. A whole continent of red men for living in community, 1 billion species of animals for being subhuman and ready and eager to take on the bloodthirsty creatures from other planets. I, technological man, grown out of this testament of my last will. So Buddha's words on conceit. Conceit has the characteristic of haughtiness. Its function is self-exaltation. It is manifested as vainglory. Its proximate cause is greed. It should be regarded as madness. Michelle McDonald Smith, who's been an important teacher for me, she talked about a time many years ago when she met with a teacher at IMS. This was actually a Burmese monk who had just spent 30 years in a cave in Burma. But anyway, he said something to her very simple. He said, "Keep your mind like water, not like a rock, but like water." I think this is useful in terms of this fixation of I. There's a hardness to that strong sense of I, of the self-righteousness, of the self-views, of whatever it is, there's a hardness. So I think it's a hardness in the mind, it's a hardness in the heart, and it's a hardness in the body, which can be observed. So I think, you know, when he says, keep your mind like water. Water moves. There's a porousness. There's a lightness. So to conceive of ourselves as a sum of moving parts without permanence, without a center, in a sense, and to perceive others as a sum of moving parts. I mean, where are the boundaries? Like, really, what are the boundaries? Mudita in the Abhidhamma, mudita means elasticity, suppleness, malleability, pliancy, non-roughness, non-rigidity. Mudita is compared to a skin that is pliable because it has been well molded by applying oil, water. Mudita of body, mental factors, and consciousness is opposed to false view and conceit. Mudita of body, mental factors, and consciousness is opposed to false view and conceit. So staying elastic, breathing, movable. When we're in an argument, just next time, feel the hardness in your jaw, feel the hardness in your heart, feel the hardness of the views that you know are right. You know, and we want to hang out there in some funny way. We want to hang out there, but we can also recognize the suffering of that hardness. We can begin to question the wisdom of wanting to feed that, wanting to fuel that. We want to fuel our judgments in some way. It makes us feel real. This is Lao Tzu. "The reason why the river and the sea are able to be king of the 100 valleys is that they excel in taking the lowest position." And I think of, you know, this lowest position, this is interesting. You know, I think the word humility is a beautiful and appropriate word, and we can consider humility the opposite of conceit. Humility not in the sense of lowly, but the humility in the sense of grounded in the truth of our interdependence, the wisdom of humility. And it's a place of kindness, it's a place of compassion, and I think it's a place of great power, this basic humility. Corrado Penza, an Italian teacher of the Dhamma at IMS years ago, gave a talk about humility, and it was so meaningful to me. He said, you know, the root word of humility is humus, earth, you know, grounded in earth. So, you know, when we construct ourselves, There's a construction, right? You can think of as constructing up and out of earth. And when we've done that, we're capable of being humiliated, right? Because something has been constructed. The littlest comment from a child, "You're so old," you know, like, right? We come crashing down. So what view, what were we standing on? Like, so asking ourselves, like, you know, if we're capable of being humiliated, it's because something has been constructed. A self has been constructed. And so that's another lens we can have when, you know, we're so afraid of humiliation, but we can actually feel joy. We can feel joy at noticing these patterns in the mind, because that's the beginning. That's the window to more freedom. So we can feel joy. I was just so humiliated. What was going on? Where was I? What ground was I standing? What ground of self was I standing on in that moment? And investigate. So maybe if you haven't been here that often, tools of investigation, R-A-I-N, it's like a handy acronym, RAIN. So R, recognize. Just recognize what's going on. A, accept. So don't quarrel, you know, don't quarrel, accept. I, investigate. N, non-identification. R-A-I-N. And I'll just give one more thing that was useful to me. James Perez said he practiced with, you know, he also said he kind of suffered with just feeling such a sense of unworthiness. He would sometimes have to give talks after Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and he just always felt like the crowd just wanted him to disappear, and just all that would bring up. And he said he would just imagine, like, he put his hand on his face and imagine it was the palm of Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin is the goddess, the embodiment of compassion. Kuan Yin holds the suffering of the world. He would put Kuan Yin's hand on his cheek and let Kuan Yin do the noting. Let Kuan Yin be the awareness, you know. So the awareness of fear isn't the fear. The awareness of self-condemnation isn't self-condemnation. So sort of finding that space. And if it's hard for us to imagine ourselves being that, we can let Kuan Yin be that soft wrap around us, that soft awareness, her quiet voice. I'll end with a poem. It's not actually a poem. It's just from an essay by André Comte-Sponville. The simple person lives the way she breathes, with no more effort or glory, with no more affectation, and without shame. Simplicity is freedom, buoyancy, transparency, as simple as the air, as free as the air. The simple person does not take herself too seriously or too tragically. She goes on her way, her heart light, her soul at peace, without nostalgia, without impatience. The world is her kingdom, and it suffices her. The present is her eternity and delights her. She has nothing to prove, since she has no appearances to keep up, and nothing to seek, since everything is before her. What is more simple than simplicity? What lighter? It is the virtue of wise women and the wisdom of saints. Okay. So we just have a little time before the children come in. I was going to have us do a little meditation about places where we feel unworthy or places where we feel superior. But maybe at your own time, this can be a reflection. It might be nice just to open up the space for a moment if there are questions or thoughts about this topic. Yeah.
We also have a microphone. Yeah, it's right here. So I'll pass it around to whoever is ready to talk.
Yeah, just so everyone is able to hear you.
And Scott, if you could pass it forward and just... that close enough? Yeah. A couple months ago, there was a survey that they discussed. I read this online that in the 50s, high school students were asked, do you feel you're special? Mm-hmm. And if someone else saw this, please help me with statistics. I don't remember exactly, but it's something like 10 to 15% said they were special at that time. Graduating or high school students now, it's totally flip-flop to where between 80 and 90% all feel they're special. And I don't know if the definition has changed, the way that we use it, or if it's just we want to raise kids to think, oh, you're special in some way. I don't know exactly, but I just thought it was interesting after what you talked about being special today, that how endemic that thought process is as we develop from being young.
Mr. Rogers. Yeah, and I think it the specialness that in the way that I was talking about it, qualifies that I'm special, meaning other people are not special. You know, I'm special by definition. Special means, you know, others are not special. So it's in that reflection. But in terms of like your place in the universe, you know, like maybe there's just a basic specialness that everybody has. You know, I think there's a way to, I don't think special is a good word, but just having a sense of our basic value. Thank you. Right.
Hi, Wynn. I want to thank you so much for this talk this morning. I want to thank you, Wynn, for this talk this morning. It just resonated with me. And kind of going through the thoughts that you had and wanting to take this home and start kind of taking you know, deconstructing the thoughts that I've had and raising children just to guide them. Are there any resources that come to mind that you say, oh, yeah, this would be a good book or a good written source to have on your bedside table to kind of help guide you or turn to? And I don't know if you have any thoughts now, or maybe we can you can post them later.
Well, one thing I could do, I did a lot of research for this talk. I could send you all the Dhamma talks I listened to because they were so useful, so informative. And, you know, a lot of this is just from my years of practice and stuff, but a lot of these, like, there was a talk by Michelle McDonald Smith and one by James Perez where just illustrating really great tools. And so I can just put a little note with these talks that I listen to as just a source.
Oh, I'd really appreciate
sure,
that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Great.
Thanks, Wynn. Sometimes it seems to me that one of the things that our society is sometimes sort of polarized between this sort of sense of being exalted, but then there is this incredible shame base. And it seems to me that conceit really gets at both of them, that they're both deeply deluded states. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you have more to say about the shame-based state, which is sometimes even hard for people to acknowledge, but that seems to me to be so fundamental so much of the time and becomes a real obstacle to practice.
I think for me, I think it was really for me this teaching that this sense of shame, the sense of worthlessness is a destructive force. And also what I also realized in all the ways that I judged myself, that also means, like, if I judge myself for being fearful, if I judge myself for being not very smart, that means that I'm judging other people I'm judging you for being old. I'm judging you for not being that bright. I'm judging you for being fearful. There's no way around that. If we have those judgments toward ourselves, those are judgments that we extend out. And in a certain way, I think I had felt it was okay to have those about myself. And when I realized that was inseparable from feeling that way about the other people, and when I got that state of heart, is not the kind of heart I want to move through life with, that changed my motivation to look deeply at shame.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.